With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by film and content specialist Cam Maitland and Brendan Ross, programmer of the Neon Dream Cinema Club. September 6th, 1994 came and went without the world ending. So did September 29th, and then October 2nd. It must have been a great disappointment to have the several dozen individual prophets, psychics, and just regular folks who got really interested in the pyramids at Giza that predicted that the world was going to end in a blaze of glory involving comets, earthquakes, and floods. Now, in the research I've done, I can't figure out exactly why everyone from the notorious Montreal-headquartered Order of the Solar Temple to engineer-turned-prophet Harold Camping decided to mark 1994 as the year it would all be over. But there was something in the air. And this, of course, was also reflected in the movies that were being made at the time. We'd have to wait till 1998 gave us an actual movie titled Armageddon, which, of course, would reignite the nation's thirst for disaster movies. But as in both our movies today, perhaps the end of the world wasn't kicked off by one cataclysmic incident. Perhaps it would be something as simple as Sam Neill as a badass noirian insurance fraud investigator piecing together paperback novel covers to discover a map to ground zero of the coming apocalypse in John Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness. Cam, do you want to walk us through this Lovecraft Carpenter practical effects fest?
Sure.
Yeah, I love this one. I just got to say, I'm a big fan of this era of Carpenter.
Okay. This era, Memoirs of an Invisible Man, this movie, all the bigs. Well, first, I do want to say, we always have these weird caveats. This movie is kind of a 1995 movie, but it's 1994 generally because it was a festival release. It was meant to be released in September 1994, and perhaps they lost confidence in it because it got bumped to February 1995. But In the Mouth of Madness, this film follows, as you say, Sam Neill as a insurance investigator who is sent to find a missing writer named Sutter Kane, kind of a loose Lovecraft / Stephen King, though Stephen King is in this universe, writer, who has disappeared, and his publisher, Charlton Heston, wants him back. He's also missing his book that they want very badly. They've been promoting. Sam Neill, as you say, ends up figuring out he's probably in this town, which may not be on a map. Editor, I guess.
I think it's his editor who appears to be so much more.
Yeah,
than his
yeah.
He's a very committed editor.
Yes, a lady. They drive to this town, which is the fictional town from his book, Hobbs End, and slowly, you know, things get crazier and crazier. It should be said that I guess this film starts like in media res with Sam Neill being taken to an insane asylum. So this is also the tale of how he went insane. Carpenter says that he likes that it was a very old-timey script in that it's somebody in an asylum being like, and this is how I went insane.
Is unhinged Sam Neill everybody else's favorite Sam Neill? Because it's certainly mine. Like, there's crotchety Sam Neill, sure. And there's unhinged Sam Neill, and I'm very big on
unhinged
Sam Neill.
I think it's Sam Neill's favorite Sam Neill, if that matters.
Yeah, and in this one, you get both.
True.
Yeah, you do. Does anyone else love that they have mixed the genres of noir and Lovecraft to make, like, noircraft?
You know, I always point people to the much-forgotten Cast a Deadly Spell, the weird HBO movies that are like Lovecraft, Cthulhu plus a detective.
Also, Paul Schrader's sequel to that. Have you seen that?
Yeah. They're not bad. They're both good, I think. It always seems like one that I'm like, why doesn't HBO, that's presumably they have the rights to it, yeah, just make more of them.
More Who Framed Roger Rabbit, but for perverts.
The monsters. Yeah.
Well, that is definitely Carpenter, right? It's like monsters, but for, you know, gore hounds and perverts. Let's do this. Yeah. And I think the thing with Carpenter in this one is that this is technically considered the last great Carpenter movie, which I think it kind of like sits on that border for me. It's part of his Apocalypse trilogy, which he refers to it as, which would include The Thing and Prince of Darkness. Prince of Darkness is very similar to this movie. This feels almost like a comedic mirror version of Prince of Darkness.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's. I think in recent years, some people have added his later films to the cult canon. I know that like Ghost of Mars really isn't as bad as people said it was when it first came out.
Yeah,
Vampires is that bad.
The one thing I will say, though, is I often want to remind people that, like, I think vampires nowadays, we just can't watch it, partially because of James Woods.
Yeah. James Woods and Daniel Baldwin, two of the...
Right, fair. Right, yes.
But I think at the time, vampires was pretty huge.
Really?
And this one, nobody cared about. So it's kind of, like, weird that this one is now propped up and vampires is like, well, that's one of the bad ones.
Now, why do you think nobody cared about this? Because, like, this is Sam Neill at, like, kind of the height of his stardom. Now he's, like, you know, a lovely oddity who pops up in people's movies who are like, oh, I know who Sam Neill is. He was in Jurassic Park. And Jurassic Park is 2 years away from this. So, like, he's still, you know, kind of primo from that.
No, it's this year. It was 1993.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
This is after Jurassic Park.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like just after. So like he was still.
That's part of why he wanted Sam Neill and nobody wanted Sam Neill, but then Jurassic Park happened and he was like, here. Yeah. Now you have to have Sam Neill.
Because
it's why he's allowed to be use his accent too.
Is he?
He was allowed to do whatever the hell he wanted.
Because he kind of goes in and out of American and Australian. Like, is he New Zealand or Australian?
He's New Zealand.
He's New Zealand. Sorry, my apologies. One accent is evil. One is not.
Yeah.
See, we have these photographs of your wife tooling around town wearing various articles that you claim were destroyed in the fire.
He definitely is going in and out to the point where I wasn't totally sure. I think when he's going full Bogart noir is when he loses the accent. But then when he starts to go unhinged, he does. He screams so well in this movie. I think one of my favorite lines that he's got is,
look, I'm sorry about the balls. It was a lucky shot, that's all.
I laughed so hard. And the other thing I learned about this is that he thought this was a comedy and played the whole thing as a comedy, which makes sense looking at it like that, and that the tone is a little unusual for this kind of film.
Yeah, I mean, it works, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it works. I think one of the funniest things is he is such a skeptic, but he's a skeptic to the point where it's almost too much. Like, he's skeptical of everything that happens in the movie. He's the kind of guy that, like, if somebody were to be like, make sure you look both ways before crossing the street, he'd be like, oh, brother, give me a break. Like, he's kind of that kind of a guy that, like, nothing, absolutely nothing will sink in for him.
Yeah.
But he seems like a character who's very much in his own world as well, because how can he not be aware of who Sutter Kane is when we are shown this world is all Sutter Kane? It's on every billboard. There's, like, posters everywhere. It's very weird he's not even aware of the
name.
I don't
think there's a brick wall in this world that doesn't have a Sutter Kane poster on it.
Yeah. I'm kind of fascinated to, like, this movie's obviously obsessed with, like, paperback horror cover art, and as big as I remember that being in the era, I don't remember there being like giant posters everywhere of every single Stephen King book, but maybe I was too young.
I do like that Stephen King exists in this world, as you mentioned, Cam. But they're like, yeah, fuck that guy. You know? Sutter Kane outsells everybody. It's pretty great.
Who's the guy that writes that horror crap?
Maybe he's too sophisticated for you. Sutter Kane happens to be this century's most widely read author. You can forget about Stephen King. Kane outsells them all.
It is an interesting world they've built. And we've talked about how it kind of sits on Lovecraftian principles, and then it kind of adds like the peanut butter to the chocolate of noir. Does anyone kind of want to talk about how this movie came to be? Because this was a script originally written in the 80s when like no one was thinking about Lovecraft.
Yeah, Carpenter was offered it in the 80s and he turned it down. He was not interested. Mm-hmm. And I think from then it went on to Mary Lambert, who did Pet Cemetery, Tony Randall, who did Hellraiser 2, which is actually interesting because I think Tony Randall also, he did the special effects for Escape from New York. So it was all kind of in the same world.
I would have wanted to see Mary Lambert's version of this because I love Pet Cemetery. Like, I love Pet Cemetery. And I think she would have brought like a really creepy etherealness to this. You wouldn't have the sense of humor, but you would definitely have like the otherworldliness.
Yeah, I'd assume that she also would have put a bit more focus on Julie Carmen's character.
Just maybe. Yeah, so he was offered it and then he turned it down. Did he say why he turned it down?
If I want to guess personally, I think that he didn't love it. Because he's like, apparently there's a copyright battle because he rewrote the script with Evgenia Sitkowitz after when they started doing it. So I think the thing is, so like Brandon could talk a bit more about it, but it's written by Michael DeLuca, who was an executive at the time who had been trying to get it made since the 80s. He started off, interestingly, to talk about Stephen King. He was one of the Dollar Baby people. He made the first version of The Lawnmower Man in a short film for a dollar. But so he'd been trying to make it for a while. He was a New Line executive. Horror was pretty dead in 1994. Like, you know, Jason was in hell. Freddy was back with New Nightmare, but he was meta, I guess.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I think Carpenter didn't love it potentially, but you have to remember too that Carpenter had just done Memoirs of an Invisible Man, which was his highest budget and biggest flop up until this flop.
Sam Neill was in that too, wasn't he?
Yes, yeah. But anyway, so I think that Carpenter was kind of on his heels. I think Michael DeLuca could make this script happen if somebody would do it. So I think Carpenter was like, this is Carpentery enough. Give it to me. I'll rewrite it and I'll make it my own thing.
Now, what was up with DeLuca? Brendan, you said that he's got some weird stuff going on over there.
Yeah, Michael DeLuca is a real Hollywood bad boy, I guess, or at least that's the image that he wanted to portray.
He purports himself to be.
I first knew about him because his name was all over Boogie Nights. He was the producer of Boogie Nights. He was kind of a hotshot New Line executive that he produced in addition to Boogie Nights. I think he did Austin Powers, Social Network, a lot of Oscar-nominated films. And I guess that gave him the power to kind of do whatever he wanted in Hollywood. So he was kind of at the tip of a lot of scandals. One particular one that apparently at some swanky Hollywood party, he engaged in a very public sexual act that I think got him in seemingly got him in a lot of trouble, but like trouble in that Hollywood way that he had a meeting and then after that it was fine. And
It's weird to me because like everyone always talks about how debaucherous Hollywood parties are, and then you're like, yeah, but this seems like, wouldn't that be par for the course according to what the tabloids want you to think?
I know that he had definitely had a track record of just very self-destructive behavior, and I think there was a lot of substance abuse. And I guess he cleaned up his act. Now he's a producer of, he produces the Oscars, I think, every year.
Yeah, that's producer jail, though. That's where you go when you're like, all right, I'm going to put on the show for everybody else. I don't get to make the actual
movies. You're in trouble. We're going to punish you by making you in charge of the Oscars.
And everyone will criticize the show, yes.
But before that, he was just kind of this like comic book nerd that wrote this script in the 80s and I guess was shopping around for a long time, and it just never really landed anywhere. And I'm guessing because this being a New Line picture, once he became kind of climbed the ranks at New Line, he was given the power to actually get this made. You can kind of see why it was passed around a lot. I mean, it's a fascinating script, but it's pretty incomprehensible, I'd say. There's not a lot of, it doesn't tie up any loose ends. It doesn't, there's not a lot of callbacks. It's just, it's kind of just all over the place. It seems very stream of consciousness. I'm curious to know what you think of the script.
I agree. I think it works well, partially. Like, I think the filmmaking makes it work because you need to. You're right. It's kind of nonsense. The movies we're talking about today both are arguably nonsense, but it's like, can you make that spooky? And this one, yeah, I think it really does. There's also this problem that I wonder about, not knowing the difference between his script and Carpenter's final one. They were trying to make it really cheap as well. Like, one thing I think kind of stinks in it is I do think a lot of the creatures look a little stupid, and apparently that's,
you don't
partially
like Meatball Muncher.
No. Partially their budget was cut from $15 million to $8 million, apparently, like very kind of late in the game, and Carpenter had wanted to do more CGI because they have a little work with ILM. There's a lot of K&B, just like rubber suit monsters, which I think Carpenter embraced by the end. He's pretty excited about it in those behind the scenes things. I think he just likes old monster movies. But if you even compare it to The Thing, a lot of the effects look like garbage and just aren't scary, you know?
No, and I think that's part of the problem is that this film has some genuinely frightening images. So one of my favorite character actors, Frances Bay, is in this, who many people would know as like Happy Gilmore's grandmother. She's kind of those like ubiquitous old ladies. She was Albertan. Did you know that?
Yeah, I knew that just through doing research on it. Apparently she also was Fonzie's grandmother in Happy Days. So apparently she's just
So she was an old lady for a long time.
Yeah. Well, remember that they make women grandmothers at 40.
Well, that's true.
Right?
True.
So yeah, just keep that in mind.
Especially in the 70s. Yeah.
Exactly. But I like some, like, going back to the imagery, like her standing at the desk because she plays the hotel owner and she's got the nude man chained to her like ankle. There's something very disturbing about that image. And then you see her kind of stomp down on the guy and you're like, oh, that's upsetting. So like it has little moments where you're like, no, that's really solid and kind of fun. But then you add in, get the silliness. I think the movie has a tonal problem because it isn't sure if it's a comedy. It isn't sure if it's meant to be over the top. And I think that's why Lovecraft really didn't become a thing until kind of modern times, is that no one really knew how to produce the films properly. In the 70s, they tackled it a few times.
Yeah. I mean, I think Lovecraft is still, and you see it exactly in this, what we're talking about with Meatball Muncher, is like Lovecraft works because it's like, here's an indescribable horror.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't work in a movie because then you're like, here he is. It's Meatball Muncher. And you're like, oh boy. In the like 60s and 70s, some of the earliest Lovecraft movies are usually like literally an invisible monster attacking people. And then it was down to like, and it still weirdly doesn't work all the time because it's like, it's the horror of the uncanny, as they say, where it's like, it's just hard to represent. And you can try with CGI too, and it doesn't help you that much, as we've seen. But I don't know. It's like Full Moon is kind of the people who do it all.
Some of the practical effects are kind of shoddy, but I do think that makes it, shoddy practical effects age so much better than shoddy CGI. And I feel like if it was more CGI heavy, it would look way jankier today.
Yes, absolutely.
I think the other issue too that you brought up is that this doesn't make a lot of sense. No. Like you can kind of wrap it around your head and go like, sorry, what happened? And supposedly they had to recut it repeatedly to be like, okay, this is reality. This is in his head. This is happening. This is not. And there's multiple recuts out there trying to make it more sensical. And I'm kind of cool just to go along with like, it's all in Sam Neill's head and that he's then watching a movie of himself and we're kind of there with him. And everyone will of course know that gif of Sam Neill in his like hospital scrubs eating popcorn. I think that's probably like, it's got to be in the like the top 20 of most used gifs on the internet. Everybody used that. I'm sure nobody knows what movie it's from, but everybody
I actually know that because I've googled I googled that gif image and I saw a lot of google of I guess Yahoo questions of people being like, what movie is Sam Neill in his crucifix pajamas eating popcorn from?
Okay, I have a question about the crucifixes. So why does he cover everything in crucifixes and think that's going to protect him? Because the bad guy is literally hiding in a church.
You're not going to get any answers from us, I don't think, on that.
I don't think we know the cosmic horror stuff. It's
I don't ask for much, just explanations of everything I do not understand.
I mean,
please,
of
go
all
ahead.
The things that I crave while watching this movie, logic is pretty low on the totem pole, I think. So I'm pretty, like you said, I'm very happy to just go along. If you want to wear crucifixes on your pajamas and go watch the movie that we're also watching, that's fine with me. Also, that particular scene, I have never, just watching it the other day, I've never missed movie theaters more. Because it's not just that you're watching someone, you're not just watching Sam Neill laughing maniacally in a theater. He's also watching the same movie that I'm watching on my couch. It just didn't seem fair. I'm like, no, I want to be in that position.
God damn it, someone else make me popcorn. I am not good at microwaves.
The interesting thing is, I think I'm shocked that they bothered to try to like make sense of it, because I think the best parts are the kind of weird, like you talk about the old lady, like the unexplained kind of book stuff. Like, you know, you just assume that one of these creeps is a creep from the books. And I also think that the camera tricks and stuff that disorient you are the best parts of this movie. Like, Brendan, I know you said that you really love the weird kid on the bike which I think is the
best bit. Yeah, it definitely is. That is, I have a real emotional connection to that scene. Just to take you back, I watched this film for the first time when I was at a sleepover party, and I was probably like 12 or 13, like way too young.
This is like the perfect and sleepover movie to scar
it really
a child.
Was. I was very invested in it. But yeah, that moment where you saw what was basically a young teenage boy trapped inside the soul of an old gray-haired man that looked kind of a bit like John Carpenter. Which I don't think that part resonated with me at the time, but now I'm like, oh yeah, it kind of looks like wild-haired John Carpenter on a bike. But yeah, that how it kept on repeating that scene, and then it kind of got a little bit spookier every time, and the next thing you know, that old man is on the windshield. I remember being so scared. I could not shake that image of that man. And I remember like later on that night when my friends were like, all right, we're going to bed. I was like, right, yeah, sleep. And I just stayed up all night long pretending to be asleep.
It's funny. I'm going to go off tangent just for a second because my experience with that was Exorcist 3. And all I could see was the woman crawling
exactly
on the ceiling. Oh, yeah. Man. It's wild how those movies just get into your brain. And it's like with stuff that as an adult, you're like, okay, that's kind of cool, but like that wouldn't hit me. Yeah. It's weird how that stuff hits your brain and kind of messes you up. But that's the imagery I'm talking about.
That's definitely an image that I don't see ever leaving my brain. I think about that all the time. Even though I don't remember much of the movie, I still think about that particular image.
Totally. And I think sometimes I think about that and I'm like, what is that again? Like, what movie is that? But it's such a good image. And I do think that that's why... Yeah, that's why when the monsters come, I'm a little less into it, because I just think that some of his best stuff is just the weird, disorienting kind of camera tricks almost. That's really when Carpenter is kind of hitting his A game.
Yeah, I agree.
This is also very much a love letter to Lovecraft, if you will. Like, the amount of care and attention that was put into this. So even the titles of Sutter Kane's books are all references to all of Lovecraft's novels as well. Like, The Whisperer in the Dark, Haunter Out of Time are all, like, The Whisperer in Darkness, Haunter in the Dark, The Shadow Out of Time. Like, they're all, like, parallel-y. And so it's kind of nice that they were throwing in, like, little Easter eggs, but they don't hit you in the face too hard unless, like, you're very familiar with Lovecraft.
Yeah, and I think it's pretty obvious that Jürgen Prochnow
from Das Boot.
I believe that's his the pronunciation. Yeah. He's obviously playing some kind of fantasy version of H.P. Lovecraft, or at least how we all mm-hmm. picture him as this wild-haired lunatic writing in a church with bleeding walls.
Now, I know we're all kind of going after the monsters, but I do like the weird back of the head thing. I think that thing is really cool.
Oh, sure. Yeah. That's like the return of the Invaders from Mars guy.
Yeah.
Another one of those little creepy.
He's got it. We were very into that in the 80s. The Quato is kind of the same thing from Total Recall. Just small creatures emerging from people's bodies.
Got a Quato. I don't know. It's very interesting. And it's very interesting to choose Jürgen Prochnow. I think he's super good in it. But I'm kind of fascinated that for a movie about like this American stuff, there's both Jürgen Prochnow and Wilhelm von Homburg.
Oh my God, Viggo the Carpathian.
Yeah, and it's his final role before he went totally crazy. If you have not read the story on him.
Please tell me. I actually don't know the story.
Just Google. Oh, it's dark and twisted and long. I will suggest you, like our listeners, Google Wilhelm von Homburg. Fascinating guy. He was a famous dandy boxer who was a very great boxer. But yeah, a lot of dark stuff in his past, and apparently not a very pleasant person. But an interesting long read if you look him up. Anyway, I'm kind of fascinated why. Like, obviously they're two weird looking guys. It's probably the truth.
Then my question is why Charlton Heston? Like, he seems like
why did Charlton Heston agree to this? Yeah. This is pretty late in his career, too. I don't know.
I think this was like an afternoon for him.
True. He's fly like, out to Toronto.
I just have to do my J. Jonah Jameson impersonation and then I'm out. Yeah. See you later.
I mean, he's a delight. He gets it. He's so good in it. I guess he's kind of a like an Omega Man tip of the hat. I don't know.
Now, everybody out now, please. I need time with Mr. Trent. Have Sylvia hold the calls and you get Linda in here.
Yes, Mr.
Gee, that was great. I almost left myself. Sit down, please.
This was also shot in Ontario. And Brendan, you've got a little bit on the locations.
Yeah, I don't know how interesting any of this will be to our non-Canadian or even specifically non-Ontario listeners. But
there are people that get so excited with like, oh my God, I know where that is. I do too. I've spent a long time in Oxford, and anytime I see something shot in Oxford, I'm like, I've been there. Like,
no, the location scouting in this is fantastic. I mean, the mental hospital, of course, is the R.C. Harris Water Treatment Plant, which is really just a perfect location. I don't even think they needed to dress it up at all. It just looks like that. The Hobbs End Bridge, of course, is the West Montrose Covered Bridge, which, aka the Kissing Bridge. Does anybody know the story behind that?
Mm. What is the Kissing
Bridge? I think it's probably, like most things, I think it's the origins are kind of gross. Like, it's something about, because it's a covered bridge and it gets dark when you go inside, it's one of those, like, don't go in there with a man or he's going to try to kiss you.
But what if I want him to kiss
me? Should
I still go there?
Negative, I think.
Okay.
But yeah, if you look it up, it is like a beautiful place. It's just this beautiful covered bridge that like we don't have any of those anymore. So it works so perfectly as the entrance to another world, essentially. And then, yeah, most of it is all filmed in Unionville, around Markham area.
Now, that church is a real church that's in the middle
of
nowhere.
Yes, that is the Cathedral of the Transfiguration, and I believe that's in King City.
Oh.
Okay, if there is an end of the world, that is where it's
absolutely
happening. Because it's
yeah,
like,
King
so
City
creepy.
Is also a strange, it's like a city that where it's kind of a normal small town, but everything is very spread out in a way that is bizarre.
Yeah.
When did you go there, Cam? How do you know?
We shot films there. It's a great place to shoot, actually, King City. I'll promote it. They gave us a great deal. They got a great subway. They treated us right.
You're looking for a real sandwich artist. That's where I go to King City.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Listen.
Finally, the last thing I kind of want to talk about here is about the soundtrack, because this is a departure from what you're usually hearing, especially in this era, from John Carpenter, who, of course, did his own soundtrack. It's not the usual synth score.
No, he really leaned into the metal. It reminds me a little bit of what David Lynch was doing in Wild at Heart. Like, it's just those like really heavy riffs that I think kind of works, because it obviously doesn't look like his 80s films. Like, it doesn't, like, it would be a weird soundtrack to put over The Fog. But for this, because this does have, like, a completely different look and feel to his other movies, I do think this kind of works.
I fully thought that it was Enter Sandman when the movie started, which at least shows that was on message. I don't know.
And then, of course, we have the Carpenter's joke, which is hilarious and way too on the nose.
I feel like that's, I mean, going back to you saying you love him screaming, I feel like that's one of the very first lines of dialogue in the movie, him in his in his little room screaming out, no, not the Carpenters, as what was the song We've Only Just Begun plays?
We've only
clearly
just begun.
Capture him.
Yeah, which, why do people not like the Carpenters? I get they're cheesy, but like, I mean, Karen Carpenter is a fucking badass, right? Like,
I think we have the benefit of distance from the Carpenters. And perhaps during its time, it was a little hard to swallow.
Especially if you were someone going to see a movie like this, perhaps this would not be on your playlist. I understand. No. Okay. I know people have
Speaking of that scene, I would also like to give a shout out to John Glover, who's a very underrated 80s, 90s, just a real son of a bitch character that I've never understood why he doesn't have the legacy of like a William Atherton for being one of those like all-time like scum buckets from the 80s.
You know, the one thing I will give him is, and it's not a show that I necessarily would say run out and watch, but he was very good as like the ultimate villain of the show Smallville. He was like Lex Luthor's evil father, who was worse than Lex Luthor. And that he was pretty good.
That would be the one thing that would convince me to watch Smallville. I will watch him play a bad guy in anything. But yeah, he's great in Gremlins 2. I think he's he's a real scoundrel in Scrooge. Pretty much everything he's in, he's just a despicable man.
More nihilism in the 80s in my horror movies and character actors. Thank you very much. I think that's the perfect place to lead us into our next movie. So when we come back, we're going to look at a movie that posits that if you want to get laid, tell them about your damp ossuary. That's coming up after the break.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
As mentioned before, 1994 was not a great year for North American horror. The mainstream was revisiting Universal-style monsters with Wolf, Frankenstein, and Interview with the Vampire, and the direct-to-video market was wallowing in sequels with Pumpkinhead 2, Phantasm 3, Puppet Master 5, The Birds 2, really, and Cam, one I'm sure you've seen, Mirror Mirror 2, Raven Dance, which I didn't even know there was a sequel to Mirror Mirror.
Yeah, I have. I remember it being kind of charming, actually.
Okay, because I like Mirror Mirror. I think it's one people really need to rediscover.
They're pretty dumb and weird, yeah. But no, I remember liking two.
Good, I'll have to look it
up. It's not like one is any good, so why shit on two?
Exactly. Well, the other movies that were kind of out and kind of making their rounds were Serial Mom and The Crow. They're both excellent and eclectic, but arguably are more violent satire and action movies, respectively. No, for one of the most innovative entries into the horror genre of, quite frankly, any year, you'd have to look to, who else? The Italians. Della Morte della Mor, or Cemetery Man, as it was released in North America, directed by Michele Soavi, a protege of Dario Argento, and was loosely based on a novel of the same name, but actually has more relation to a comic book by the same author, Dylan Dog. We're going to get into that. And as I was watching, I couldn't help but think, this is something that my sister would really love. So I called her and I said, so it's an erotic black comedy zombie movie with a nihilistic bent. And she asked where she could watch it. And clearly we are related because this is a movie that is very much up my alley too. Brendan, how would you describe this little oddity and what is it about?
Oh boy, how much time do we have?
Yeah, a half an hour. We have a half hour.
I think I can wrap it up in half an hour. Basically, the setup is Rupert Everett kind of plays this put-upon cemetery caretaker that some people call him an engineer. He is tasked, I guess his main task, in addition to just, you know, upkeep, is re-killing the zombies, which they call returners, once they come back to life.
Which is a great name for a zombie.
Yeah.
Returner's an awesome name, yeah.
But the thing that I really, really love about this is that, I guess, we don't really have a lot of context. You don't know when he started, but clearly he's been doing this for a while. So it's gotten to the point where he gets no excitement out of doing this. And he kind of plays this as if he's like a corporate accountant that's been at the same agency for 40 years. So it's just kind of like a hassle. Like he always rolls his eyes when there's, you know, a banging at the door and a army of zombies kind of comes into his sleeping quarters. And he just kind of rolls his eyes and gets out his gun and has to like shoot them one by one in the head and then goes back to, you know, putting together his skull puzzle or whatever he was doing at the time.
I call it zombie.
Yes, thank you. So that's kind of the setup.
Thank you.
It morphs into something a little bit more sinister and kind of less fun, but I think we can kind of start with that and then reveal it organically as we go along.
Because this is a film that is almost indescribable. Mm-hmm. Like so much happens and it shifts tones so often. No, you did a great job. You did, for what it is, you did an excellent job.
Yes. You set it up. Well, yeah, I think you shared the clip where Rupert Everett talks about it like a series of comic strips. And I think that's probably the best way to make sense of it. Because, yeah, it's nine different movies. And some of them just literally happen one after the other. Some of them don't have much to do with the next
one. Some of them are like blink and you miss like an entire feature film's worth of content. And then it's like, oh, and that's over and now we're on to something else.
Just so you know. But hey, here's the boobs. There you go.
That's the one thing that is consistent.
The boobs. Yes, and decapitation. You're right there for both of them. Cam, let's talk a little bit about where Rupert Everett was at this time, because this is kind of a weird point in his career.
Yeah, especially for North Americans, they probably wouldn't have much of an idea who Rupert Everett was. Rupert Everett became famous in England first for this movie, Another Country, which doesn't get that much play here in Canada. It's a fairly early 80s queer film with him and Colin Firth. Hey, really? To everybody out there.
Is Colin Firth considered a queer icon? Because I know he's in that Tom Ford movie where he's...
Yeah, I mean, I guess. I think he's just everybody loves Colin Firth. Apparently, him and Rupert Everett have a lot of bad blood because young Rupert Everett was a bit in love with him and treated him poorly. Rupert Everett blames himself for being a dick to Colin Firth, and they still have some sort of feud. So that really boosted his profile. Then, interestingly, Rupert Everett goes on to do a lot of films in Italy and France. So he was quite big in Europe at the time. And he is also what you want to set up for me, a pop star. as you know, I love my 80s people becoming pop stars. So he had a song called Generation of Loneliness. I suggest you look it up. It's a bit of a new wave hit because this is kind of late 80s. But yeah, of course, he didn't really cross over in North America till the late 90s. So this is before that. But the interesting thing to know is... this character Dylan Dog from the comic is visually based on Rupert Everett. It's drawn to look like Rupert Everett. So weirdly, when they were casting Delamore, Michael Suave was like, well, we have to get Rupert Everett. And Rupert Everett was not even Rupert Everett is like, you know, he is weirdly famous in Italy because of Dylan Dog.
Yeah.
Almost more than the movies he did. Because he did one Italian movie and I think two pretty big French movies. But yeah, it's interesting that he has this 80s career that people might not know. He existed before My Best Friend's Wedding and was relatively famous. And this movie did, like it should be said, it was released in 94 in Italy and in 96 in North America. And it did huge in Italy. And people were so excited for Rupert Everett. And Anna Felci, the woman lead, was like, oh my God, I'm acting with Rupert Everett? Like, she said that it was like her third movie and she couldn't believe she was with a celebrity like Rupert Everett.
That's so funny. Well, I guess in Italy, anyone who has like a name outside of Italy is like, oh my God. But I get it. It's like Jerry Lewis for the French, right?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
There's just an appeal.
But I mean, it's also just like knowing this hermetically sealed, like Anna Felci, she says... she was famous because she appeared in an advertisement that was directed by Fellini, and it was the last thing he ever directed. But she's like, that made her famous.
Okay. She is that classic Italian beauty that's not Sophia Loren. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's something, I mean, she's an incredibly gorgeous woman, but she has that very, like, almost feline sort of quality that we associate with Italian beauty. I mean,
she looks a lot to me like the lady from Life Force, too.
Yeah, good call.
Unearthly
sort
of look.
Yeah, it was a very, like, made a deal with the devil to look that beautiful kind of quality to her. I just looked her up recently, and she still looks like she's, like, 26 years old even today.
Yeah.
It's not fair.
Same with that Life Force lady, too. It's weird. They also both look exactly the same as they ever did.
Well, it makes sense that she's playing these multiple characters. And, like, as I'm watching her play, like, and unfortunately the character name is just She, which I fucking hate, because we're coming off of The Passenger, where it's just the girl, you know? So, like, Italians, pick it up. Come on.
Well, at least at this point, She is, like, nine different women.
I was going to say, I also hate that. But it is true. There's so many different characters that in this context, I'm a little bit more forgiving.
You get it.
Yeah.
It is. Like very Joe versus the Volcano for me, though, you know, where he keeps running into her in various iterations. Yeah. Man, what are we talking about Joe versus the Volcano on this podcast? That's like perfect.
That's
it.
Just you. You've got Joe on the mind. I will say the other kind of fascinating thing with Anna Felci is, number one, she was very briefly a model, but she hated it because she said that's like boring. She wasn't interested in it. So, and then the other thing is she considers this role great. She like still considers it one of her best roles. And the funny thing, which is like a sick dig on the Italian film industry, is you could tell that people kind of asked her like, well, you know, there's a lot of sex and this is kind of a whatever role. She's like, it's still one of the best written roles for a woman I've ever been offered, because she's like, she does so many different
things.
She
plays more than just a victim, which is, you know, more than you can say for a lot of Italian horror films and giallos.
Character's a victim. The first character just gets bitten by her dead husband and then dies of fear, which is like, sorry, what?
Oh, Dr. Vecchese, are you spying on us?
No, I've drawn up the death certificate. Her heart stopped from fear. It wasn't the bite that killed her. She died while making, well, you know, doing it.
But she eventually convinces him almost to cut his own dick off.
So. Yes. That's where this movie goes off the rails. That's like the Reanimator part of the film. Like, it's very weird.
Yeah, that's the first part in the film that you're like, I'm sorry, what now? Like, where are we going with this?
Yeah.
How can I? I mean, everybody knows that... haven't got one. see, you have got one. Well, when would you like me to relieve you of your problem?
No.
And that's the part I remember so much. In this rewatch, like, this is a movie that I will say I have a long history with. Perhaps only for Brendan or Canadian fans of a certain vintage, I first saw this movie on the Showcase Drambuie at night on Showcase.
I remember you used to play
it. And I loved it. And there was like a bunch of movies that were very hard to find that were on Showcase. This one, like Francois, was on sitcom. So I was always looking, and I eventually got this one on DVD. So this was like a DVD I dined out on for a while when it was very hard to find. Because this movie is like, it's kind of fascinating. They say that even when it was released in Italy, there was very few prints of it. And then, yeah, the American release was very small, and then the DVD release was kind of whatever, and it only recently came back again. So it's always a film that seems to barely kind of exist. Yeah. But, yeah, it's a fascinating one because I can watch it so many times, and I still don't. To me, I was like, this time I was like, man, I really thought that impotence part was like an hour of the film, not like a five-minute aside. It's very weird.
It's very weird, but I think that's what makes it great is that, like, it just keeps surprising you, but not in a way where you're like, oh, I'm out. In a way of like, sorry, what's happening now? We recently watched Face Off for season 3 of the TV show, which is coming up. And I had the same experience watching Face Off where, like, you can't question any of the weird shit that's happening because shit keeps happening. So you're like, sorry, what's happening? What's happening? What, what? And you just stay in it and stay in the vibe. And even though the tone is kind of like swinging between comic book and like Hammer horror and like all these classic influences, it's still pretty straight and narrow, nihilist, grumpy, which I kind of love, but with a sense of humor.
Absolutely. There's really never a dull moment in it. It's always moving. And I think it does, like, even though it kind of jumps all over the place in tone, that like stream of the sense of humor it has, the visual style, and in kind of a weird way, the romantic thread always kind of stays consistent through all of it. And when I say romantic thread,
you're talking about the one,
when I say romantic thread, I do want to specify not so much between Francesco and she, more between Francesco and Miyagi.
100%. And Miyagi, I think, is one of my favorite henchman characters of all time. And I have to say that I'm a very big fan of any character that expresses affection by vomiting. Like, it's just
such an endearing moment. I love you. I really love that scene.
It really is. And then she's
with it.
She loves it because she's a weird severed head. Yeah. I will say that that's like, I think of one weird sticking point if you're new to this movie is kind of sit out, because at first Nagi can seem a bit like a weird broad stereotype of like a mentally disabled person, but it's much more of like a weird fantasy archetype that is, it's very unusual, but it kind of works by the end. And the other thing to know is I think that this movie kind of suffers from a bit of a like Don Draper syndrome where the character Della Morte is meant to be a shit that is living his life wrong, but he's so sexy and cool that you're kind of like, all right. But it's like, you're never supposed to think this guy is good.
And that's and if you do at the beginning, that opinion is definitely challenged midway through.
But that's what I think makes this different from an American film, is that because he is an anti-hero, they would try to make him likable in some way, but he's not likable.
No, he's a real bastard.
And you actually...
No.
And one of the reasons why you revel in terrible things happening to him is because he is a terrible person.
Yeah.
So there is that affection for it that way. And Miyagi is kind of his like other half of like the innocence and the sweetness, where he just wants to hang out with a severed head. He doesn't want to do anything gross with it.
No, and there's actually some complexities to Miyagi's character. Like, he is actually like a very... he's kind of a sweet guy. And there's also like an element of like, it kind of just kind of dips into the fact that he's possibly like a savant of some kind, like some kind of like a secret genius. The way that what did you call it? The skull puzzle?
It's the skull puzzle.
In the way that when like the whole movie, Francesco is trying to put together that puzzle, and then there's that one moment where Miyagi just kind of takes it and puts it together really quickly, and then when Francesco comes in the room, he goes, oh, and he quickly undoes it so that Francesco can't see. There's like a little brief moment where you're like, oh, that could have been another half hour of plot right there. Like, what's going on there? But then it was like, nope, just that one moment, and then we're going to move on to something else.
I do like how upset he gets. He's just like so turned off by people having sex in the graveyard. He's like, nope, not for me. See you later.
He takes his work more seriously.
Yeah.
It's also also interesting to point out he is also a celebrity of some ilk,
right?
Francois Haji Lazaro. Yeah, it's so hard to make a through line between English music and French music, but kind of like a French punk for this band called the Butcher Boys or Les Garçons Boucher. But you can look him up, and it's quite fun. He plays like, you know, he's playing like a hurdy gurdy while people
sing a lot of like white t-shirts and suspenders, like that type of a band.
Yeah,
there's a lot of this movie that's kind of fascinating to me in terms of the way it looks, because it's not made for a huge budget, and a lot of Italian stuff, like, they do really amazing stuff with imagery and visuals. Like, I mean, look at anything Dario Argento does, especially like Suspiria, thinking of how little a budget Suspiria was made from, and it's so iconic in the look. This is kind of sitting in the same thing, and there's almost a Baron Munchausen-y sort of influence to it, and I love that death animatronic much, because there's something janky about it, but just janky enough to be genuinely terrifying and fit in with everything.
Stop killing the dead. They're mine. If you don't want the dead coming back to life, why don't you just kill the living? Shoot them in the head.
Yeah, and I mean, Suave was an AD on Baron Munchausen, so
really?
Maybe he even got the same animatronic. It's hard to tell. Yeah, Suave's kind of a fascinating guy, because he had a significant acting career. You can see him in lots of movies like Demons and stuff. And he also was a significant AD for a long time. He actually didn't... He kind of says that he was happy. Like, he thought he had reached his career peak when he was Dario Argento's assistant director. And he said he kind of didn't really need anything else beyond that. But Joe D'Amato asked him to do Stage Fright, which is kind of one of his more famous movies, The Owl with the Chainsaw, if you don't
excellent
know off the top of your head.
I'm looking
totally. And then he kind of had, it's very hard to, again, outside of the like hermetic seal of Italy in the late 80s, early 90s, it's hard to tell, but he was kind of considered like a second coming of horror because he has these great movies, the Church and the Sect. I really love The Sect, actually. If you like In the Mountains, In the Mouth of Madness, The Sect is very close. And yeah, so he's this kind of weird guy, but I think he learned so much from the cheap guys. Like, Joe D'Amato got him to do Stage Fright because they had such a tight budget. And he's like, well, Suave's been around for all these other movies. You do it. And he's like, oh, okay. And then he's kind of a fascinating guy because he said, like, he's like, once I did Cemetery Man, what else am I going to do? He kind of hasn't done horror again because he's like, well, what's left?
Yeah. I had the zombie jumping out of the grave on a motorbike. What
yeah,
more
that,
do
that
you
really
want
is
from
that?
And I think, those
career
visuals are part of it.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, and I think, yeah, visually it's so crazy. I'm super into, there aren't a lot of Italian comic adaptations, even in Italian film. And so it's kind of interesting. There was, of course, a kind of terrible Dylan Dog adaptation with Brandon Routh. Yeah, there's Italian comics, especially Italian horror comics, have a very specific style. Part of the problem is they're essentially pornographic. I recommend / don't recommend Buyer Beware, Not Safe for Work. There's a blog called The Groovy Age of Horror, where a guy translates a lot of Italian horror comics from the 60s and 70s, and you can kind of get the idea. But like Diabolique is a Italian comic. Like, there's a handful of them, but this is the closest that gets to it because it has the weird erotic elements. But it has, the nice thing is it has the humor that was in Dylan Dog. But yeah, man, it's weird. I don't know. This all came from you talking about the visuals. I don't know what else to say. The visuals are great. They really hold up.
I mean, and I actually did look into, like, because the cinematography really did strike me. It's shot by someone named Mauro Marchetti, I believe. Pronunciation, who really doesn't have many credits on his name as a cinematographer, but he was a camera operator for Apocalypse Now, Last Emperor, and Popeye. So he obviously knows his way around a camera.
A little bit. Yeah. No wonder this looks as gorgeous as it does and is like bleak but rich simultaneously.
And I also think that there's like definitely a level of satire that I think flies over my head, be fair. Because it's like, you know, they're like Nyagi's watching Gulf War footage at one point. And like, obviously there's some twisted like Italian bureaucrats, like the weird mayor who just wants to use his daughter's corpse as like a photo opportunity. So there's obviously more going on if I was Italian in 1994, sure. Probably.
Now, my question for you guys is, this was, of course, released under the name Cemetery Man, which is definitely not as good as Della Morte, Della More. Like, that's just like the death of love or death and love or however you want to translate it. It's much better. And Rupert Everett, when he became a big name after My Best Friend's Wedding, was trying to get an American remake made of this. And I don't know if this could ever really be translated for a wide American audience. I think it's so unique.
Yeah, I can't see it working if it was made for, like, in North America. That seems like a tough one. They'd have to pare down a lot of content.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, it's also in English.
Yeah.
Come on, guys.
Yeah.
Like, they should have just tried to get a better release for it. I don't know. But yeah, I'm fascinated by that. And I think it's nice to know that he really loves this movie, too. Like, Rupert Everett is very proud of this movie.
I think he wanted to continue, like, not just do a remake, but his idea was to keep it going and make this into, like, a franchise. And, like, he was kind of more passionate about it than the director was in a lot of ways, I think.
Yeah, they still talk about it. The Suave's talked about it a bit. Suave had a personal tragedy where his son was quite sick, and he kind of disappeared from filmmaking for a while, and now does TV. But yeah, I always wonder, because you kind of could, but also I guess I don't know how do you continue the story. It kind of ends with an ending, you know?
It's them trying to escape, right? This is the great escape. It's Cemetery Man 2, the
just
great
come
escape.
Back. They're like,
escape the snow globe.
Yeah.
We talked about how In the Mouth of Madness was kind of considered by many people the last great John Carpenter film. I think in a lot of ways this is considered the last great Italian horror film. And this is kind of like the last hurrah before a lot of these directors kind of moved away from film and kind of went to television. And I guess this couldn't compete with North American releases. I'm not sure exactly what it was, but this was kind of the last big hurrah of Italian horror.
You're totally right. And I have never understood why.
Yeah.
It's like Dario Argento got hit in the head with a rock and stopped
movies. None of these guys, like, he definitely didn't stop making movies. He still watches, he still makes unwatchable film every year, it seems like.
Yeah.
And then we try to just, like, recreate them, like the Suspiria remake, right? So it's like, okay, we're not financing new innovative ways. But it is nice to see how, like, a lot of these have kind of influenced stuff. Like, this is definitely an influence on Shaun of the Dead. Like, it's got to be.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it's interesting that you I read a Carpenter interview where he was talking about Suspiria versus, weirdly, In the Mouth of Madness. And he brought up just that, like, that Italians dream their horror movies, and he can't do that. So he was, like, he was kind of comparing the more traditional script of In the Mouth of Madness to Italian horror. And he just said that he doesn't know how to do it.
I've never heard that before, that Italians dream their horror, but oh my God, did that just click for me and make my brain kind of hurt. I was like, yeah, because every single one of them that I like has that, like, super ethereal quality where, like, it just kind of dream logic shifts from one event to another.
Yeah, and I mean, it was a great talking point by Luca Guadagnino when he remade Suspiria. I didn't like the remake of Suspiria that much, but he said he was not remaking Suspiria. He was trying to film the nightmares he had after he watched Suspiria. Which is, like, that's a great little turn
of
phrase.
How does that get
witch
past
orgy.
The pitch?
Bloody witch orgy.
I know. But also, how does it not be scarier? Come on, man.
If it was any other director, he would walk into a studio meeting, say that, and they would say, sir, we're calling security.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you won an Oscar, Brendan?
I have not. So I obviously don't know what I'm talking about.
From what I understand, that is your golden statue ticket to making whatever weird shit you want to make.
Yeah, I just want to mention that something to point out is that Tangerine Dream was actually supposed to do the music for this, but had to drop out. I think it was just scheduling conflicts, but it definitely adds to a great, like, what if. I mean, I love the music in this a lot, but I mean, nothing's better than a Tangerine Dream score, right? Like, imagine how much this would have been elevated. Like, I already think this is close to being a perfect film to me, but I think with a Tangerine Dream score, my goodness, that would have been something else.
Yeah, I actually feel like the soundtrack, and it's probably not the fault of the movie, but it's the fault of a decades of Full Moon Features having that kind of like, like I kind of hate it, and it sucks to know. But yeah, I love that. I also was looking at the Tangerine Dream thing, and the closest I got was they dropped out because something else came up.
That was where my research
began. Like
a
euphemism. Yeah,
creative differences is what we're looking at there. And with creative differences, we will end our episode for this week. So once again, I want to thank Cam Maitland for joining us for some serious weirdness.
Well, thank you. I'm always here for serious weirdness.
I know you are. You're my Serious Weirdness Tour 1998. And Brendan Ross, thank you so much.
Thank you for inspiring me to watch two movies in a row of depressing jobs that are made to seem weirdly cool.
Now, you do not have a depressing job, but it is weirdly cool. Tell people how they can find you and your work.
I don't know. Just go to Toronto and ask around for me. Somebody will know.
Social media at all? Do you find yourselves on any sort of room that possibly people could chat in?
No, you can look up Neon Dreams is on Instagram. Sometimes during the pandemic, while theaters are closed, we are occasionally doing online screenings that are a lot of fun. So follow Neon Dream Cinema on Instagram for updates. And like I said, just ask around.
Fantastic. Yeah, please check it out. It's really great, especially the neon streams. Lots of fun that you can have on your own couch until we can get back into theaters. And you can join us next week as we go full camp in 2000. And we're going to be joined by comedian Steph Malik as we look at some unconventional queer classics in Cecil B. Demented and But I'm a Cheerleader. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to email the podcast? You can do so at podcast@hollywoodsuite.ca. Want to chat with us and find more great content from Hollywood Suite? Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free. Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cam Maitland. Today's guests were Cameron Maitland and Brendan Ross. Supervising producer is Ryan Mains. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagne. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.